untangling fornication.
When a word meant to confront demonic evil was turned against ordinary people. There are few words in modern Christian language that have caused more confusion, fear, and quiet devastation than the word fornication. It is spoken casually, often confidently, applied to teenagers, young couples, private thoughts, moments of awkward human development, and sincere people trying to live well in bodies they did not choose and desires they did not invent. It is used as if its meaning were obvious, as if it were timeless, as if it described one simple thing. It does not. And when a word meant to name the darkest forms of spiritual and human evil is simplified, diluted, and repurposed as a catch-all label for ordinary sexuality, something monstrous happens. True evil is minimized. Ordinary people are crushed. Those two things should never be confused. This is not an argument for promiscuity or exploitation. Scripture condemns what destroys people and devours community. This is something else. It is a refusal to let God's language be stretched beyond God's intent, because when it is, consciences are crushed under burdens God never placed there.
What Scripture was actually condemning. To understand why Scripture speaks with such force about porneia, a term often translated fornication or sexual immorality, we must return to the world in which that word lived. Not our world, not modern church culture, not purity movements, their world. In the ancient Near East and the Greco-Roman world, sex was not merely personal, it was religious. The gods of Canaan, Egypt, Corinth, and Rome were not treated as myths or metaphors. Scripture never speaks that way. They were understood to be real spiritual powers. Demanding, violent, controlling, and terrifying. And Scripture names what stood behind them plainly. They sacrificed to demons, not to God. Deuteronomy 32, verse 17. What pagans sacrifice? They sacrifice to demons and not to God. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 20. This is not poetry. It is spiritual diagnosis. These powers demanded payment, crops, fertility, prosperity, protection. And when they did not get what they wanted, people believed the gods would curse them, ruin the harvest, strike the womb, bring disease, take children. Worship was not preference. Worship was survival under terror.
The horror of temple prostitution. Temple prostitution was not sexual freedom. It was organized spiritual violence. Human bodies, male and female, were offered to gods as currency, sometimes by force, sometimes by poverty, sometimes by fear, sometimes by vows made in desperation. Sex was stripped of intimacy and turned into transaction. Bodies were used repeatedly, often publicly, until they were broken, until disease ravaged them, until exhaustion and abuse killed them. And this happened in sacred spaces, under altars, beneath incense, with priests present. Sex became a ritual instrument, a way to purchase favor from gods who never stopped demanding more. And God refuses to soften his language about this. Through the prophet Ezekiel, God speaks with deliberate revulsion. "You played the whore with the Egyptians," he says, "because of your fame, and lavished your whorings on any passerby." Ezekiel 16. "You were insatiable in your whoring," he says again. Ezekiel 16. In Ezekiel 23, the language becomes even more disturbing, graphic enough that many churches refuse to read it aloud. God is not indulging shock. He is matching the horror of the act with the weight of the words. This is what idolatry does to bodies. This is what worship of false gods costs.
From prostitution to fire, the same devouring lie. Scripture does not treat temple prostitution and child sacrifice as distant evils. They belong to the same moral universe. They share the same lie. If I give what is most precious, the God will bless me. If I give what is most precious, the God will increase my crops. If I give what is most precious, the god will make me fertile. If I give what is most precious, the god will protect me. A father offering his daughter into sexual use, and a father offering his child to fire, are not morally distant acts. Both betray the sacred. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech. Leviticus 18. They burned their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. 2 Chronicles 28. This is not ancient ignorance. This is demonic predation.
They were acting from terror. We must be honest. They were acting from terror. They knew the god was real, and it was. They believed refusal would cost them everything, and it would. They believed obedience might save what remained, and they were right. That is why Scripture does not mock idolatry. It confronts it. Flee porneia, Paul says, 1 Corinthians 6. Not because God is fragile, because the trap is real.
Why porneia had teeth. When Scripture condemns porneia, it is naming practices that share one horrifying core: sexual exploitation, abuse of power, violation of family boundaries, betrayal of covenant, the fusion of sexuality with idolatry. This includes prostitution, incest, adultery, coercive unions, and ritualized sexual use. These are not mistakes, they are predatory systems. And this is why applying the same word to ordinary non-marital sex is morally obscene. It is like comparing a scraped knee to brutal murder. They are not the same. Not even close.
Jesus and the collapse of moral control. When Jesus said, "Whoever looks at a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery in his heart," he was not building a tighter purity code. He was dismantling self-righteousness. He was saying, your ladder of moral achievement will not reach the kingdom. Jesus removes the ladder. He does not raise it. Religious systems did the opposite. They turned his words into a trap with no exit. No space for learning. No space for development. Only shame. That burden did not come from Jesus.
How this word was turned into a weapon. Institutions thrive on expandable guilt. The Pharisees did this with the law, adding, twisting, and choking the life from the people. And later, institutions learned the same method. If a word can be stretched to cover everything, it can be used against everyone. This is beyond tragic. It is grotesque. It is blasphemous. It takes language meant to confront demons and turns it against human beings.
God's wrath. A father's war.
God's wrath is not irritability. It is protective love in combat. The Lord will execute judgment on all the gods of Egypt. Exodus 12. He disarmed the powers and authorities. Colossians 2. Wrath is what love looks like when it enters a room where children are being devoured and says, no. Wrath is rescue.
Wisdom, teaching, and the gift of the body. Sex is not condemned in Scripture. It is taught. Like food, like wine, like power, like money, all are gifts. All require wisdom. Bodies must be taught, not shamed. Desire must be guided, not terrorized.
A final word. Writings like this do not come from ideology. They come from years, from living long enough to see the damage, from loving enough people to feel the cost. From no longer being afraid of who might be offended. If you carry shame handed to you by religion, hear this clearly. God's wrath has never been aimed at you. It has always been aimed at what devours. Truth, spoken in the spirit of Jesus, does not crush people. It liberates them.